Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The power of artificial intelligence is being incorporated in more and more parts of daily life. Smart software, for example, is being used with security cameras. Some apps conduct searches of video footage not much differently than how you search Google for a name or a recipe. But the integration of AI and video is far from perfect. Tech journalist James Vincent recently wrote about where the technology stands and what could be ahead for potential pros and cons of AI and surveillance for The Verge. Check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. James Vincent joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back on.
What are the biggest challenges in getting AI programs to work with video?
The big challenges are fairly prosaic. They mostly come down to the image quality and the positioning of the cameras. There are technical challenges as well, though, and that's all about context and how do you teach a computer program to really understand the human context and what it's seeing, rather than just, say, identifying how a human body is posed.
Yeah, let's talk about the quality of the video, because it remains shocking to me how bad video is, surveillance video is. What is the deal with that? We could put a man on the moon, but I swear to God, video of man on the moon walking is better than most of the video in your local thrift or your local convenience store.
I think that's always just been a sort of cost-benefit analysis where people have gone, you know, how often do we actually need this? How do we actually use this? Why do we have a camera here? Is it really to catch high quality footage, or is it a deterrent? When people come into the store and they see it and they think, okay, I'm being watched. And I think CCTV in the past, that's always been a big function of it. And this has meant that high quality video and, you know, having these good angles showing clear shots isn't that important. But this is exactly what AI and other technologies are going to change, because they're going to turn these passive observers into active observers that really do analyze what we're doing.
One product you wrote about is called Ella. Can you talk about what it is and what it's capable of?
Yeah, of course. So Ella is a first product from a company, sorry, not first product, called IC Realtime. They launched it last December and they kind of unveiled it earlier this year. It claims to be and wants to be Google for CCTV systems. So what you do is you pay this company a subscription. It starts at about $7 a month, and it costs more the more cameras you add. And then this software, which you can get on a computer or you can get on your phone on an app, it will scoop up all the footage from your CCTV system, and then it will categorize it. It will recognize what is going on in each clip. It will record, you know, the most interesting bits, and most importantly, it will let you search the footage. So this is being pitched at pretty much anyone who has surveillance cameras. So it might be that you've got a couple dotted around the exterior of your house, or it might be you're running a mall, or you have some large facility, maybe you have 20, 40 cameras, and then you hook Ella, named after Ella the elephant, because it never forgets. You hook Ella into this system, and it will let you search your footage. So, for example, you know, maybe there was a robbery, but you didn't notice for a couple of days, and you spoke to a witness, and they think they saw a Jeep Wrangler, heading off east around that time. Rather than having to kind of manually search through all the footage yourself in order to find that particular clip and pick up a few more clues, you just type Jeep Wrangler into this search engine, and it will find you every clip that has a Jeep Wrangler in it. So built into this system is a catalog of different objects, which includes car makes and models, and they're adding to this over time. So in the end, or you know, with updates, they want to add things like people recognition, facial recognition, and really more sophisticated searches.
Could it get to where it's people recognition and files of known criminals?
Well, they did actually mention that as a possibility. So this is not something that is being sold to law enforcement, this particular product, although similar products, I'm sure, are being tested and developed by contractors who cater to those sorts of customers. But the CEO did speak to me for this story, and he mentioned that, you know, he thought that once lots of customers had plugged their CCTV, their surveillance cameras, into Ella, then the police might, for example, enter a mugshot if there was, you know, some sort of manhunt on, or if you were just looking for a most wanted, and then it would search all the footage all the time for those people. And of course, that raises, you know, huge questions about what is a fair use of that power, and, you know, how would you give oversight to that? Because it's essentially recruiting citizens into their surveillance of their neighbors.
You also wrote about a company called Boulder AI that's building artificial intelligence right into their cameras. What's the difference between that and analyzing video in a cloud like, say, Ella would?
Right. So the difference is that Boulder can kind of put their cameras in weirder places, basically. Hmm. They don't have to have a connection to the internet, unlike Ella's cameras. Which would have to be connected to a Wi-Fi network, for example. And the same is true of the sort of smart home CCTV cameras you can buy, because lots of companies are selling these now as well. Although, again, they have, you know, relatively basic features, but they need to be connected usually to your home Wi-Fi network. Boulder, by comparison, they slim down all this computing software and they pack it right onto the chip. And that means that you can just drop this camera anywhere, and that can be in, say, an industrial environment where you might have a lot of metal about, and that means that it can be difficult to get a signal. Uh-huh. Or you might put it somewhere very remote for scientific purposes. So their product is kind of like the boutique end of what this technology can do. And they have built, you know, very specific systems. So they have one, for example, that is installed in a dam in Idaho, where the owners of the dam, to meet environmental regulations, they need to make sure that fish are escaping from the dam. So they have a fish ladder, which is sort of a vertical waterway. Mm-hmm. And they used to have a man just stood in front of this fish ladder, counting the fish over and making sure the right ones were getting through. And instead, they just put a camera there, one of these smart AI cameras made by Boulder, and it sits there and it counts the fish for them instead. And not only counts them, it also identifies the species.
Wow. I mean, I can see this being used in livestock operations.
100%. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that when we talk about this sort of AI CCTV, obviously how it gets used by governments and law enforcement is one aspect of it. But I think the wider picture is just that we've gotten much better at teaching computers to understand the visual world. And that opens up so many applications. Everything, you know, just everything you need a human to look and check, you can now, if you teach a computer, you can pass that task on to them. And there are obviously certain subtleties that are really difficult to teach. Mm-hmm. But as you said, livestock would be a fantastic use of this. Just counting cows in and out of a barn, for example.
AI-enabled camera, though, you mentioned, I think, early on that the subtleties of suspicious behavior might escape it, at this point at least.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So this is something that obviously you tend not to hear so much from the companies,
of
because
course.
It's in their interest, especially these startups who are trying to break into the business.
Mm-hmm.
It's in their interest to, you know, really hype up the capabilities of this technology. But the sort of the technical people I spoke to and the people who look at this from an ethical side, they were both saying, for different reasons, that it's really important to remember the shortcomings of this stuff. So from a technical perspective, while we're very good at recognizing, using AI and other sort of computer vision techniques, objects and scenes and sort of basic actions, so you show a computer a picture and it'll be able to tell you, oh, yep, that's, you know, someone brushing their teeth, or, yep, that's someone, I think they're cooking, you know, they're in a kitchen, I reckon. You know, it can't tell you more subtle observations about a scene that to a human would still be really easy to pick up on. And you know, the example I gave in my piece, and I think one that's pertinent to, discussions of AI CCTV is, if you see someone running down the street, you know, if you just see them out the corner of your eye, it takes a couple of seconds, but you will know, you know, are they running because they missed a bus? Are they running because they're in trouble? Are they running because they just stole something from someone? You know, even in a couple of seconds, it's very easy for a human to take in a scene and fill in that context. And that's just something that, like, there are just too many variables to be able to teach computers to do that reliably. And so that's a technical problem, but it becomes an ethical problem when you think about, okay, so if we've got these limited systems, how much responsibility do we give them? How much do we trust them?
Mm-hmm. And how much do we so far?
So far, we're building a trustful relationship, a trusting relationship with them. Whether that's a good idea or not, I think is a really complicated question. So in terms of how far these systems are being implemented, today, there's nothing as complex as what I've described, currently running anywhere major. Mm-hmm. But instead, we have these sorts of limited applications. So, for example, you get license plate tracking, which is extremely common in the UK, but pretty uncommon in the US. But I know, for example, we had a story on The Verge recently about ICE starting to use this in order to track the movement of immigrants. And then you have things like facial recognition, which is obviously becoming more and more common in places like airports. You know, different airports around the world, including in the US, are trialing it as a way of just tracking people coming in and out of the country. But these are controlled environments. It's easy to pick up a license plate because if you're pointing a camera at a road, a license plate appears in pretty much the same place. You know, it may be a little higher, a little lower, but you know what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And if you're in an airport and you're doing a border gate, then you have a chance to just get a really clear shot of someone's face in the same way that you do with the new iPhone. You know, you hold it up to your face, it gets a good shot. What's difficult, this brings us back to what we talked about at the start, is putting this into situations where you have low quality footage or you have footage at awkward angles. You know, a CCTV camera is usually up high and it's usually kind of pointed to get the best view of an entire room, not to clearly see someone's face. Mm-hmm. So this stuff is not widely implemented. But as the technology gets better, we're going to see more applications. And I think they will start off being quite specialist. So, for example, there is the startup WeWork, which leases office space to different companies. Mm-hmm. And they started using video analytics to track where people move within their buildings. So they can say, oh, cool, this building is good because more people hung out in the kitchen. We should design more buildings like this, whatever. So I think you get these small uses, and these will slowly accumulate until we become a little bit, familiar with these. Technologies.
And comfortable, I would imagine the makers of these technologies hope we become more comfortable with them. But there are ethical concerns, and you touched a little bit on it. Like, I know when I go into a convenience store, it tells me if there's a surveillance camera in use. But eventually, will there be longer signs saying a surveillance camera's in use? It is equipped with AI, and it could be shuffling your picture through the multitudes to see if you're a good guy or a bad guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a completely legitimate question. Should that happen? Because cameras like that are going to exist. And yeah, they probably will be installed in those sorts of places. So does the public have a right to know about what their image is being used for and when? So this is something a lot of ethicists I talked to were very worried about. And they were mainly worried about the chilling effect that it would have. So it's not so much that it leads to, instant and obvious injustices. It's that it has this insidious creeping effect on how we conduct ourselves in society. And they said, how do you feel when you know you're being watched? How do you act differently when you know you're being watched? How does it change your behavior subconsciously, unconsciously? And I think although, how this technology gets integrated in the US is going to be very different to how it gets integrated elsewhere because of, cultural and societal approaches to these sorts of basic values. But a really good comparison is how it's being used in China, where, it's much more authoritarian state and the police and law enforcement, they really don't have any qualms about deploying this technology if they think it's going to be useful. Mm-hmm. And this is somewhere where we've seen that police are really happy to deploy this. And they use it, especially in the western region of China called Xinjiang, where there is a minority Muslim group called the Uyghurs, who are sort of repressed by the state. They use it to track them. And you know, people who have been there, reporters who have been there, there have been some very good stories on this, have said it's sort of like the closest we've got to a total surveillance state, where simply the movements of every individual are known pretty much all the time. You know where someone is. If you want to know where they are, you can find them easily.
James Vincent, thanks for talking with us today. I appreciate your time.
No problem, man. Thanks for having me on.
That's James Vincent. He's a writer for The Verge. We will have a link to his article about technology, where the juxtaposition of artificial intelligence and surveillance videos. Go to WOSU.org/allsides and check that out. Stay with us, though. We have more coming up on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Research shows the experience of using a smartphone releases the chemical dopamine that stimulates the reward centers in the brain. This reaction is universal, but of particular concern for the developing brains of adolescents. Some parents and educators are taking action. Joining us now by phone is president of Screen Education, Michael Mercier. Screen Education is a nonprofit organization that works to limit the negative consequences of screen addiction through research and education. Welcome, Michael Mercier.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Tell us what we know, what the evidence is about the impact of screen time, smartphone screen time on the brain.
Right. Well, you as you explained, there are aspects of social media and smartphones that are generating dopamine hits when kids use them, and it's pleasurable, it's stimulating, so they start to seek that. They start to seek that dopamine hit. And that accounts for the fact that they can't put their phones down. They're constantly cycling through their the different sites that they're on, the social media sites, news sites, sports sites, checking their notifications, their text messages, and trying to get that hit of dopamine.
It's the same, though. I mean, I'm thinking, why? Do we know why it does that?
Well, I don't know if we know exactly why. I mean, they've done brain imaging studies that have shown that you get the dopamine hit, and they've done brain imaging studies that show, like, people who are on video games, the same portions of the brain light up as when you're on cocaine, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? There are Silicon Valley basically has analyzed the features that cause this dopamine hit. And so they've come to understand the features. So, for example, social approval, right? If you get social approval or social validation on a social media site, you get a dopamine hit, right? There's also the anticipation of good news, you know, something positive happening. So, Silicon Valley understands the mechanisms that trip the dopamine. And they actually work with product designers and psychologists, brain experts, to engineer their apps so that they're as addictive as they can be. And that was a big, 2017 was a breakout year for this issue, because we basically learned that was going on. We learned that it was intentional, mm-hmm. right? And then toward the middle of the year, we started to learn just how serious and dire the consequences are for kids. There's a psychologist at San Diego State named Jean Twenge, and she published an article in the Atlantic Monthly that went viral, and it was titled "Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation?" And Jean, for 25 years, she's been looking at generational data, and she started to notice, and it was around 2012, that measures of psychological health for teens were dropping precipitously. So they were far more anxious, depressed, more suicidal and less independent from their parents. So the other big realization in 2017 was, wow, kids are addicted. in many ways, it's intentional. You know, Silicon Valley wants this to happen, and it's seriously hurting the kids. So what we're seeing now toward the end of the year and into the new year is a backlash. We're seeing a big backlash against the Silicon Valley and the apps developers.
You researched adolescent smartphone addiction and the summer camp experience. A scenario where they removed the smartphone during camp. Tell us how you conducted the research and what you learned.
Yeah. So first of all, my motivation for doing this is, you know, I've been watching this issue for about 3 years. And whenever people talk about solutions, all they really talk about is imposing limits from externally on the kids. So, you know, saying we're not going to allow you to use your phone during these times. We're going to use these apps to limit your access. And no one's really talking about the complement to that, which I think is necessary, which is to, at the same time, develop within the kids the ability to limit themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Because at some point they're going to be independent, and if they've never had to limit their own use of screens, where are they going to be, right? So, so that's what motivated my research. I wanted to find an environment where kids were deprived of their phones for a significant period of time. And I realized, because of my own kids going to camp, that there's a large percentage of summer camps that don't allow kids to bring phones. So I thought, well, that's the perfect environment. I'll go in there and see how the kids reacted to this. You know, how did they react to being without their phones for 2 to 4 weeks? Mm-hmm. And did it raise their consciousness, right? Because I feel like the key to helping young people begin to develop the ability to self-limit is raising their consciousness through experience of these negative consequences. So I started off the summer before last. I went into 2 summer camps several times throughout the summer and did focus groups. And it was remarkable. I found that these kids, and now these were 15-year-olds, and they had been at camp for 2 weeks, and they were fully aware that smartphones were causing them problems. There was no mystery there. Before they even came to camp, these kids know that there's a problem. And, you know, they talked about, you know, feeling addicted. I would do, you know, ask them to raise their hands and say, how many of you consider yourself to be addicted to your smartphone? And depending on the group, it ranged between 30% and 80%. So the average is like 50 to 55, which echoes what we've heard from some of the national studies that are being done. Right?
And just because you don't think you are doesn't mean you aren't. But go ahead.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But these kids talked about, you know, when I'd say, well, what's it been like without your phone for the last 2 weeks? They'd say things. Well, I'm not tripping as much as I used to. So, you know, because my face is in my phone. But the biggest insights that they were very emotional about this. There was a lot of energy behind this. Was number one, they all said that we would not have gotten to have known each other at camp if we had been allowed to bring our phones. Wow. They were aware of this. And I had one girl who said, you know, you see those 6 boys at the other end of the table. I know all of their names and I know a lot about them. And I guarantee you, if I had my phone with me, I wouldn't be able to name any one of them. And I know nothing about them. I wouldn't have gotten to have known them. And then the other big finding was, they were shocked at how well they slept, and they were nearly unanimous about that. And I'd say, well, why? You know, they would say, I can't believe how much better I slept at camp. And I'd say, why? And they'd say, well, you know, you go to bed and it's 10:30 and you have your phone in your hands and you get on Netflix and you watch a video and then the next one queues up and you watch that. And before you know it, 2 to 3 hours have gone by. And then they talked about getting notifications throughout the night that wake them up. So those were the 2 big findings. And then that was in the summer of 2016. In the summer of 2017, I did a much more extensive study at another camp in the Cincinnati area. And this involves gathering a lot more data. So I had them, these kids were at camp from 2 to 4 weeks, and I had them fill out questionnaires, like reflecting on their experience after the first week. And then at the end of the second week, at the end of the third week, we had small group discussions, which we recorded. And then we waited 4 months, and in December, November and December, we surveyed them to see, you know, looking back on this experience, what are your thoughts? And the big insight was that these kids were so relieved to get away from their phones. They talked about what a burden their phones are.
Yeah.
And on numerous levels. So, you know, I heard a lot of kids say things like, it's, you know, it's a relief to not have to keep up with all my notifications and reply to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that one level. They feel this obligation to reply to everything that's, you know, every message that's sent to them, every notice that they get. And it's just a burden. But there's also, some of the kids talked about the anxiety of, there was one girl who was nervous because she said, well, my friends know that I'm away for 2 weeks and don't have my phone. And I'm afraid they're going to talk about me behind my back. Someone else said, well, there might be rumors that I can't dispel about me, you know? So there was this tremendous sense of relief from these kids at getting away from their phone. But another big insight was they went on and on about how they, if they had had their phones with them at camp, they would have sat around in their cabin all day long and done nothing. They would not have been aware of their surroundings. They wouldn't have gotten. Yeah.
Well, did it change their behavior after camp? I mean, did this awareness translate into anything substantive?
That's a good question. And that's one of the reasons I did the survey. I wanted to, you know, I waited 4 months to do that survey.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see if there was any lingering effect. And there were two things I wanted to see. Number one, did you try to self-limit your use of the phone? And then number two, did you try to influence someone else? So about 20 to 22% after leaving camp tried to limit their use of their phone. And now I could only capture so much information. So I don't know if that was, you know, in some cases it appeared from their response that they created a new rule that they followed over time. Right. In other cases, they gave a one-time example. So it's hard to know if that was a change in habit. Right. To me, it was a positive thing to hear that just from having this experience and having your consciousness raised on their own, they at least wanted to, right, attempted to, and in some cases succeeded in trying to limit their use of the phone. And then it was about 17% said that they tried to get a friend, to make a friend aware of how addicted they were to their phone and that they could go without it.
So. Well, when my kid was going to a camp, it was going to be a month-long camp. He did it for 3 years in a row. And the first year he went, one of our big yay thumbs-up things was that they were going to ban cell phones. And we were at that first meeting, and they said, well, now we're going to change that policy. And I said, no, you're not, or we're pulling out. That was a selling point to us. But what surprised me was it was parents who were pushing for it. Parents were pushing for the connection, not the kids.
Right. And it's what's interesting. The last 2 years, there's an organization called the American Camp Association, and they have the annual meeting, national meeting, and then the regional meeting. So in January of 2017 and then this year, 2018, I presented my research at the Ohio chapter of the ACA.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I heard from a lot of the camp directors, that I was initially surprised because I thought, oh, they're certainly not allowing kids to bring phones because they know that this is an issue, this addiction, and they don't want them to be addicted, right? Mm-hmm. They want to try to break it. But that wasn't the case. What I found for the most part is it was a practical thing just to keep kids engaged. Right. But also there's this tie to the parents. Right.
And, I see. Yeah.
You know, so someone gave me an example. We had a child who was homesick after 3 days and texted their parent at midnight, and the parent showed up at 2 a.m. You can imagine being, you know, with security concerns and, the camp directors didn't know what to do. How are they going to validate this parent's identity? You know, how are they going to be sure? It was a big issue. But you're right. The parents are often, they've told me the parents are often pushing to have the kids have phones. They often sneak them in, they'll put the phone in the kid's bag and try to maintain communication that way. And that is a big issue. Yeah.
We mentioned earlier, or I didn't mention earlier, but France is banning smartphones in school. What do you make of that tactic as far as France is concerned?
I see that as part of the backlash. So, the backlash, you know, we began to see the backlash like around December. And one of the big events was this, the big news events about the backlash was France banning the smartphones for kids who are 15 and under. Right. And I actually, I talked to a high school principal in the Northwest who did the same thing starting in January. And, you know, for me personally, I think it's a great move. And there are schools that do that. I mean, there are a lot of schools that they either ban them or they don't allow kids to use them. You know, you can bring your phone to school, but it has to stay in the locker. Or I talked to one school where they're allowed to use them during lunchtime, mm-hmm. right? But I believe they're going to see a big change in the behavior of these kids in terms of socializing. Now, this principal that I talked to in the Northwest, so he started with the new year with this new policy. He said within 2 to 3 weeks, he said the kids seemed relieved. That mm-hmm. was his first observation. But number two, he said the kids started congregating physically, right? Getting together outside. Yeah.
It's like wild, you know, Wild Kingdom or something, or watching how kids interact without.
Right. But he said they hadn't been doing this before. So they'd start to aggregate outside in the cafeteria when they had free time and actually talk to each other. And this, I want to go back. The research I did this last summer, that was the other thing that was remarkable in the comments. It's hearing kids talk about, you know, well, I learned that this new thing of talking face to face is really so much, but it was this alien thing. Like talking face to face is really so much better than texting and messaging. They'd say I got to know my camp friends much better than my friends back home at school because they were talking face to face. And I think, you know, this principal that I talked to was describing sort of the same thing. They felt relieved, but all of a sudden you have this new behavior emerge. Of all of a sudden people are talking face to face and you actually notice it as a principal.
And then fights start breaking out.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the downside, right?
No. Well, listen, this is really interesting, Michael Mercier. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Michael Mercier is the president of Screen Education. That's a nonprofit that's working to mitigate the negative consequences of screen addiction through research and education. More Tech Tuesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Apple last week reported good news for investors. Earnings and revenue are up for the tech giant, even though Apple sold fewer iPhones than the previous year. Joining us to talk about how that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So Apple's making more money but selling fewer phones. How's that work?
Well, I mean, a lot of it comes from the iPhone X that came out this year. It's, you know, significantly more expensive than the iPhone 8 or the iPhone 8 Plus. And it was something that a lot of analysts were kind of wondering if you know, people were going to line up in droves to buy this phone that started at $1,000 and went up from there, you know, as opposed to the $700 and $800 phones that are already considered kind of high-end and expensive. And it turned out that the answer was no, that there weren't nearly as many people lining up to buy this new phone, you know, for a couple of reasons. But it didn't seem to matter a whole lot because the enough people bought this more expensive phone that it did more than just kind of balance the equation. It ended up where Apple ended up making more money.
Because it was more expensive?
Yes, because the amount of money that Apple made per phone was higher.
How much difference was the 10 over the 8 or the 7 in sales?
It would really depend on the model. The most expensive version of the 10 is almost $1,300.
Okay.
You know, so it's considerably more expensive than, say, the cheapest version of the iPhone 8, which is, I think, $649. And then the prices will fluctuate depending on what region you're in and if one is on sale or something like that. But you know, when it comes to that kind of launch day expectation where people are lining up day one to get that new iPhone, there's a considerable difference in price.
Is this in a way a relief to a company like Apple that they don't have to depend so much on the rollout of the next phone, that it's dispersed not only among, you know, in the pricing of the phone, but also from its other services?
It definitely gives Apple some flexibility, and it also, you know, is a solid signal to Apple regarding what its customers are willing to spend. You know, we see a lot of companies making $300, $400, and $500 phones, and there's a lot of kind of market chatter saying, you know, this is the way the smartphone market is going, whereas Apple is making quite a bit of money going the opposite direction.
It also, as I mentioned, makes a good deal of revenue from services such as iTunes, right?
iTunes pulled in a ton of money. It's still not, you know, as popular as other streaming audio services yet, but it grew pretty considerably this year, which is another thing that wasn't a guarantee at the beginning of the year.
And the HomePod, it's going to hit store shelves soon. What are you expecting there?
I don't think that this is going to sell a ton. I think that, you know, people who are locked into the Apple ecosystem and who don't already own, say, an Amazon Echo or the more expensive Sonos speakers, they'll be interested in this kind of all-in ecosystem where you can get, you know, deeper into the Apple network and everything just kind of works together automatically. But I think people who are interested in the idea of a smart speaker, they've already started to invest in these other ecosystems, and pulling away from that is going to be really hard to do when the base model for Apple's HomePod is $350.
Apple is late to the game when it comes to the smart speakers.
They're late, but not in a way that really matters. You know, this is something that's still so early for Apple and Google and Microsoft and Amazon to do a lot of this stuff. Where Amazon has seen a ton of success is selling these things at the lowest possible cost, and we already know that Apple isn't going to do that. So their focus is on audio quality. They want this speaker to be something that fills the room and is the best possible sounding speaker. And the early reviews seem to suggest that that is what they have accomplished.
And once again, with the iPhone X, cost made up for the lower levels of sales. Is that kind of what you think is going to happen in this other stuff?
Right. This, you know, these speakers are going to be very expensive. They're going to tie directly into the Apple ecosystem. This is exactly what Apple wants for their first generation of users.
We're a split household.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the feeling.
It's hard. In other smartphone news, a couple of companies are releasing limited editions of red-colored phones. One of these is the Honor 7X, is it called? It's a budget-friendly smartphone. What's the deal with red?
You know, there's you know, been some running jokes that this is to tie in with Valentine's Day, but it's more than likely, you know, just to test the waters and see how people are responding to kind of a new color for a phone. This kind of thing makes me unreasonably excited, you know, because I'm a smartphone nerd to begin with, but also because every phone, you walk into any Verizon or AT&T or anything, all the phones are the same color. You get the you get the whitish silver and you get the black, and they're just so boring. And outside of the US, there are typically a lot of phone manufacturers that will release in a lot of different colors. We don't usually get those colors here in the States. And so it's exciting that Honor and OnePlus are you know, focusing on these bright red versions of these phones as options coming into this year. And I hope that it's the kind of thing that encourages other manufacturers to bring some additional color here to the U.S. because I'm really tired of black slabs of glass.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. It's just boring when you walk into one of those stores. You mentioned the OnePlus 5T. They have a lava red edition, is what they're calling it.
Yeah, so you know, coming along with you know the new color is some kind of weird name to you know make it sound, and it's no different than the names of cars that are in different colors. I kind of roll my eyes when I hear them.
Yeah,
they are both bright red, you know, very, very noticeably bright red phones. One has got, you know, kind of a matte texture to it, the one from Honor, whereas the OnePlus is a little glossier and kind of stands out a little more. But they're both this very, you know, candy apple red. You know, I wouldn't go so far as to call them, you know, Valentine's Day themed or anything, but it's certainly, you know, that shade of red.
Well, why do you think red and not neon green or yellow or orange or any other colors that might strike a person's fancy?
I think red is one of those colors that stands out in such a way that someone will go out of their way to find maybe a clear case for their phone so that color continues to stand out.
Okay.
Whereas other colors, you know, it may have just been that they decided, you know, that they were going to go with one color, and red is the color of things like sports cars and other, you know, kind of exciting things. So that's kind of the default when trying a new color somewhere.
And then you mentioned someone might get a clear case so they can see the color red through it. But are cases still a big necessity going forward, do you think? Or are they going to try to make those cameras a little, I mean, those cameras, well, the phones a little sturdier?
I definitely think the cases are going to continue to be a big deal, even if they continue to make phones sturdier, which they are. You know, there's a lot of anxiety when it comes to dropping a phone. And so it's really common for a ton of people, you know, as soon as the phone comes out of the box, it goes into a case.
Yeah, I wish I would have done that, but what are you going to do? I now have a case again. Having a case is a hassle. If you have a purse, it doesn't slip into anything easily.
Yeah, it's very true. And, depending on what the case is actually made of, it can, pick up a bunch of junk or grime can get, in between the case and the phone. It's a lot of hassle to have a case. I appreciate holding a phone without a case, but I definitely understand the anxiety of dropping a phone.
So what kind of cases do you get for your kids?
Typically the biggest ones I can find because my oldest is real super clumsy, just like her dad. And so, there's been some drops in our house. So they typically get, whatever sturdy case I can find.
With airbags on the sides and stuff like
that.
Speaking of cameras, which I described a phone recently as, Google is set to bring major camera improvements to its Pixel 2 phones. This all has something to do with the Pixel Visual Core. What are we talking about?
So this is kind of interesting. A ton of the apps on your phone, regardless of who your manufacturer is, have the ability to take pictures. Facebook has its own camera built into the Facebook app, and Instagram is the same way. But those cameras don't behave the same way as the actual camera app that came with your phone. You know, Google makes certain software available to just that camera app. So when you want the best picture, you usually go to that app, and then you share from that photo gallery to Instagram or Facebook or something like that. Mm-hmm. The Pixel Visual Core is Google's attempt to make those things that make their camera so good available to these other apps. So Instagram's camera app will still have all of Instagram's features and filters, but it'll also have Google's post-processing efforts to clean up things like noise and make it work better in low light and things like that.
Why didn't they have it available when the phones were first released?
That is an excellent question that Google refuses to answer. This is something that the company's been working on for a while as a way to improve not just this current line of phones, but, kind of all of their phones moving forward. And I think doing so in a way that makes it easy for developers to kind of add to their existing applications was kind of challenging.
So what does it mean for the average user who has a Pixel 2 phone? Are they really going to know or care?
They will probably not know or care, but... things like Instagram and Facebook, the pictures that you take from those camera apps are mm-hmm. going to start looking a lot nicer.
So I'm just wondering about the tactical message here. They're doing something that doesn't really matter to the user that much. What's their motivation to improve it?
A lot of it comes down to, the camera on this phone is just so good. There is a ton of competition between, which camera on a phone is the best. And for the last 2 years, it's been Google's Pixel phones have been, kind of the best camera that you can buy on a phone. But that really doesn't matter a whole lot if all of the apps that you use can't take advantage of the thing that makes the camera as good as it is. And so this is a way to, keep people interested in what is the best camera that you can buy, in that it works with all of the apps that you're already using. Someone who's using Snapchat is way more likely to use the camera app that's in Snapchat than they are to use the camera app on the Pixel and then share that thing that they recorded to Snapchat.
Remind me again what makes Pixel 2 cameras so much better than the rest of the crowd.
It takes just an incredible shot when the lights are very low, when there's almost no light going on. The amount of detail that it captures in both the foreground and the background are fantastic. It uses a piece of software that Google calls Auto HDR to balance out the foreground and the background so that you actually get, the correct amount of color in both areas. It's a lot of weirdly technical stuff that just means that your photo is very, very pretty when it's done.
And how much do they cost?
The Pixels start at $649.
Okay, so they're not cheapies. They're right up there.
Yeah, Google makes these to compete directly with Apple's iPhones.
Yeah. Microsoft is changing how it rolls out new operating systems. So Windows 10S was formerly its own edition of the operating system, but now it's being sold as a mode that runs on top of other Windows 10 software. Okay, what's going on?
So when Microsoft released the Surface laptop, it came with a version of Windows called Windows 10S. And this was a simplified version of Windows that was designed to only allow you to install applications from the Microsoft Store instead of being able to just kind of download anything and install it and run in kind of a secure environment and be, you know, look and feel like Windows, but run very differently. And that caused a lot of problems with people who are used to the way that apps work in the Windows operating system, where you can get something from the internet and just install it and it works and everything's great. And it was complicated by the fact that there weren't a ton of great apps in the Windows Store to begin with. Microsoft's been working really hard on this because this is a much more secure way to run your computer. And when you're getting a computer to give to a child or to give to, you know, a grandparent or something like that, this kind of simplified version of Windows is a great deal safer. So they ran into a ton of problems with the Surface laptop where, you know, people were buying it and removing Windows 10S and putting, you know, regular Windows 10 on it. I, myself, being very guilty of doing that exact thing for my daughter. And so Microsoft's approach to this, instead of making it a version of Windows that you have to go through all of these steps to remove if you don't want, is to enable it so that anyone running Windows 10 can enable this Windows 10S mode. You know, and have it be this kind of safe version of Windows that someone can use.
Will it lead to a broader change in how Windows systems are updated? Is this going to be normal?
Microsoft certainly hopes that it's going to be, and it certainly could be moving forward. The challenge that you run into here really is making sure that the apps that people want are available in the Microsoft Store to begin with. Because if someone, you know, wants an application and it's not there, the next step is to try and get it from elsewhere. And if you try and get it from your web browser, but your web browser doesn't allow you to download that application and run it, then the next step is going to be to try and, you know, change that. And if Windows 10S stops you from changing that, then people are going to want to stop using Windows 10S.
Hmm. Before I let you go, I wanted to get your thoughts on the idea of screen time for kids, especially teenagers. I don't know if you heard our previous segment about that with Michael Mercier, of Screen Education. What do you do with your kids?
Well, when it comes to screen time, my kids have a finite amount of time that they're allowed to use on a school night, and that gets expanded a little bit on the weekends, but it's based entirely on you know, their performance during the day and what their grades look like and things like that. But it's never above an hour on a school night and never above 3 hours on a weekend. And the 3 hours is really kind of an extreme maximum if we really have just no other plans for that weekend.
Stuck in the car or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. What about the anxiety? Michael Mercier was talking about how kids were kind of relieved to have the phones taken away from them and being given limits.
Yeah, that's kind of a challenging thing to start with. You know, my kids have never been in an environment where they had an unlimited amount of screen time, so it's hard for me to make that comparison.
Uh-huh.
And then my oldest, who would be the most likely to spend all of her time, you know, on a phone, has been pretty hesitant to use phones, you know, for a ton of communication after some of the stuff that she went through last year.
Right.
So it's a little difficult for me to compare, but it wouldn't surprise me to see, you know, a lot of, you know, kind of preteen and teenage kids acting that way.
Hmm. Russell Holley, thanks as always for your insights. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.